Hello, and welcome to another edition of Required Viewing. I'm laughing because Shams was just making fun of how I opened this. Here, Shams, you do your opening then.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, fellow people. Welcome to another edition of Required Viewing. I'm your host, Shams, and with me is my co-host, Zach. And we are excited today to talk about a recap, actually, the season, or first season, we can talk about this later, of Lovecraft Country, which ended last week. We're recording this a week later. It's a 10-episode run. And so today we want to kind of recap a few episodes that we felt were the most interesting to talk about, and then recap kind of the finale and the show as a whole. And then kind of talk about how we kind of view the show in terms of the larger TV landscape.
Yeah, so we talked about the premiere episode. We pretty much dedicated a whole podcast episode to this back in August. So it was a pretty strong premiere. I don't think we need to review any of that. So Shams and I have picked two episodes each, with the expectation that they might overlap, and they definitely did, on the one I guess we would overlap on. So I've selected two episodes. Shams has selected two episodes in total. It's three unique episodes that we're going to talk about. And then we will also talk about, overall, you know, where does this show land in the landscape of 2020 content, and you know, what the strengths and weaknesses of the show overall are. So without further ado, let's get into it. So you want to go chronologically? I think it makes sense to go.
Yeah. Also,
episodes in order.
If in case it wasn't self-evident, this will obviously have a lot of spoilers. So if you have not watched Lovecraft Country, I think we can't really avoid it, given that we'll be talking about episodes 9 and likely the last episode. So yeah, this will probably have spoilers, so just keep that in mind.
Speaking of spoilers, this first episode I picked is probably the main mid-season twist of the show. But that's not exactly why I liked it. So episode 5, did I count that right? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Episode 5 is called Strange Case. This is the episode in which Ruby, Letty's sister, starts to get, you know, real close with the character William, spoiler alert, aka Christina. And this one I was looking forward to, because in the initial reviews of the show, the critics were given, they're always given like a certain number of episodes ahead of time to watch to write their reviews. They don't get to see the full season. And the reviews of the show before the premiere were very strong. So I knew that they were given episodes 1 through 5. So I figured, you know, it must end on a pretty strong note with episode 5 if that's all they got to see and the reviews were so strong. Overall, I'm not 100% sure that was the case, but I do think this episode was probably one of the more interesting, maybe controversial episodes, which is makes it interesting to me. I think problematic is probably the word that the writers were using. So, Shams, what did you think of this episode? Also, I guess you could talk a little bit about what the main plot point of it was.
So I actually think this was best or second best. One top three episode for the show overall. I'll put it that way. So this show, I'll get into the spoilers basically. The premise of the so this is a Ruby centric episode. I think the show surprised both of us when we realized it was kind of serialized more than we thought it was going to be. The first episode was kind of setting the picture, but then we saw there were certain character-centric episodes, and some of the episodes can kind of be taken separate from others. So this episode is specifically on Ruby and really focused on this idea of a black woman living in a white woman's shoes. And I mean that quite literally.
specifically living in her very high heeled shoes.
Yes.
Relevant to the ending.
Yeah, right. Because the premise of the episode is that Ruby is able to take a potion that turns her into a white woman. And so a lot of the episode is kind of focused on like how she uses her ability to be white to get things that she could not get as a black woman. So earlier in the episode, they allude to the fact that she wanted this job at this department store that had the first integration of their staff. And she did not get that job. And so she uses her whiteness to essentially get a manager position. And the show kind of implies that, you know, she just lies and she's white and she basically gets it. And so I think the problematic part of the episode is that she enjoys it, right? She actually there's some aspect that she enjoys and takes pleasure of. And I think the line, and maybe you can correct me, she has a specific line where she says something that like, they weren't afraid of me, but they were afraid for me. And like the difference of how that felt for her, where for the first time in her life, people were thinking of her and not trying to be running away from her. That gave her like this empowerment. And so,
oh, I remember the scene you're talking about is when the younger black boy kind of bumps into her as the police are coming up, and then the police start yelling, and she instinctively in the body of the white woman puts her hands up.
Exactly. So it's problematic because I think the problematic comes part that she kind of becomes selfish, right? When she becomes white, like she's thinking of like, what can I do to gain for myself? Right. And like, I think it's a really interesting episode. I probably would need to watch it again to really dive deeper in terms of like what it's kind of saying about like racial, really the different, not just racial, but very specific racial of white woman versus black woman. Right. It's looking specifically at white, not just white, black, but white woman versus black woman. So it's really interesting. I actually thought the twist at the end was kind of obvious. I don't know. Like, it didn't shock
me. Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely saw that coming. That wasn't to me what made this episode interesting. It was really the performance of, you know, not only the white actress who's playing the, you know, Ruby in the body of someone else, which is a really interesting performance to pull off as a white actress, but also in the scenes where Ruby is herself, or in kind of the gory scenes when she's transforming, the Ruby actress does a really good job of portraying the kind of like the guilt and shame of like enjoy that, what you were saying, enjoying it. To some extent, even kind of taking her anger out on the other black woman who works at the department store, who kind of took her her quote unquote spot. In the previous episode.
And then later on feels guilty when she sees that woman she thinks that woman, oh, she has it made, but then she sees how her coworkers treat her and her boss treats her. And she realizes that, oh no, she's still getting the short end of the stick. And really the reason why I like this episode a lot is because it uses this sci-fi fantasy premise, right, of metamorphosis to then kind of tell this story, right? So I think it blends the two of those things really well. I honestly forget what happened with the other characters in this episode, which is kind of a flaw of the show, I feel, is that in most of the episodes, I feel there was usually one good plot thread. And then the other plot threads usually would kind of be like...
Yeah, this was the episode in which... I think this is the episode in which we spent a lot of the rest of the time following Montrose through the balls. God, what's the show? I'm forgetting the name of... like Pose. there's a lot of scenes where Montrose is kind of living in a separate show. It's almost like Montrose is in a spinoff show of the show Pose during this entire
it's when Tick finds out he's gay.
Tick finds out Montrose is gay. That just honestly, that just completely was lost in the much better A storyline of this episode.
And that's like, I can just kind of step aside for a little bit. To me, that was a bigger problem with the series, that there was always usually one plot line that was just weak every episode. And it was like very jarring how weak it was. Right. And so it was like, when you're watching the show, you're just like, it felt like there was like a shift that like you went from like a quality HBO show to like a Showtime show. and that's kind of, okay, but,
and so this episode ends at, like, so there's that tension between, you know, what she's doing and how she's treating the black coworker, and then when she kind of sees her being harassed by the male white manager, the climax of this great episode kind of leans into the Lovecraft Country brand, I think, which is that, you know, going back to that very first scene with Jackie Robinson slicing Cthulhu in half with a baseball bat, there's this over the top nature, over the top, like gore nature of the show. And which allows, you know, this episode to end with Ruby assaulting the white male manager with a high heeled shoe in certain places on his body.
Yeah, actually. And I forgot to bring that up, because that whole manager part actually kind of goes in this deeper thing where, cause he has a line when he says, like, cause the reason why he hits, it's implied, at least the way I interpreted, that he was hitting on Ruby even as a white woman, was because he could still smell like the black woman inside of her. Cause when he was harassing the other girl, I forget what her name was. He like, it's like smelling her up, and he has this one line he says about like how like black woman smell makes him feel a certain way, right? And so to me, I interpreted that like that's why, because Ruby's white character is the only one who is being harassed. Like the other white coworkers aren't being harassed by this guy, right? But she was, right? And I think it's implied that, like, you know, he can still smell that black woman inside of her. And so it kind of made her realize that, like, you know, she, even when she looks like a white woman, she can't fully become white, I guess you can say. So yeah, I think the episode combines the Lovecraftian premise, the gore, really well in this A plot. I think it's a very interesting racial subtext, gender subtext. I think I'd have to watch it again to really look at how problematic it may be. It's one of those episodes that at least makes you think, right? And if I watched it again, I could determine, well, was it as successful at making us think as it thought it was? But it at minimum tries really to make you think. And that's kind of something I'll say about the show as a whole, is that in terms of effort, it's an A+. Like, there's a lot of things we'll get into criticizing and saying it may have fallen short, but the show tries. Like, it definitely tries to do it. And this is an episode that tries, and I think it mostly succeeds.
Yeah. And when we say problematic, I think we'd agree. This is not like we're not saying we have a problem with anything it's trying to say. It's one of those things where, the writers, when they were writing this, were asking, I know this from the, you know, the podcast, with the actual writers of this episode, they were asking themselves, like, you know, should we do this? And when you start asking yourself that in a creative medium, you're probably on the right track. The answer probably should be yes. Now let's get into, immediately after this episode, we have episode 6, which is the, you know, the one episode we both chose, to talk about. And I think for me, I think you said the same thing. This is the strongest episode out of the 10. And also one that really, I think, solidifies the style of this show is really, it's an episodic show, not really like a serial drama. Like, I think we'll get into the weaknesses of the show as a whole later. And that is really, there's a really convoluted plot that kind of strings everything together. But in reality, the show is at its best when it's kind of treating itself as and leaning into just like a collection, almost like an anthology.
Collection of short stories.
It's almost like Black Mirror-esque to go back to the show that launched this podcast.
In fact,
as if we've gotten anywhere. So
it
this
probably
is episode
been a,
six. Meet me in Daegu is the title of the episode. And this is, for any of you who have watched the show, this is the episode that takes place, I think, entirely in Korea during the Korean War.
So I really, really like the first half of this episode a lot. I think it's the best. Basically, up until Tick comes in, I thought it was amazing. When Tick comes in, I actually felt it got a bit weaker because it kind of turned into this like generic Korean War romance story, which I have actually seen before. And it kind of wasn't as... It kind of became a bit generic. For those who are interested, there is a movie called See You, Sayonara, starring Marlon Brando, about a Korean War romance. And that was very similar to how the second half of this episode felt. But the first half, so Jamie Chung, what's her character? Is Jing Ha?
Jia.
So you kind of start, it's like you kind of have known about this character up until this, because you've heard her voice. So you know she's existed, but like you don't really know much more. So it's like this really interesting start where you see her watching a Judy Garland movie, and she's like dancing, and then you realize it's just like a fantasy sequence and she's just kind of alone in a movie theater. And then you kind of see her day-to-day life as a nurse. And you kind of see that she's being rejected by all these men.
And her mother's pressuring her to bring a man home.
Yeah.
Which is quite relevant. So and means something different later.
Right. So it starts with this very kind of like, okay, like this is normal, right? And it does a really good job of making you feel sympathetic to her character within like the first 10, 15 minutes, right? And then, of course, the twist, I don't know exact time frame. I think it's around the 15-minute mark, maybe 20, I forget, where the big reveal comes in, where she brings home a man and she starts having sex with him. And then tentacles just start coming out of her, literally everywhere. And she essentially kills a man. And then you essentially find out that she is actually like this like monster spirit thing. And that, like, the mother, like, she was the daughter of this woman, and that the daughter died for some reason. And so the mother made a pact with a shaman to bring her back. And when the shaman brought her back, she essentially put the spirit inside of this, her daughter's body. And in order for her to cleanse it out, the spirit has to consume 100 different souls. That was kind of what I took. I actually don't know if that's exactly what it was, but that's kind of how I interpreted like the whole situation.
Yeah. It's called Kamiho.
Kamiho. Yeah.
And for anyone, so this is definitely the most dark interpretation of the, because this is a common, Korean mythological creature, I guess you'd call it. For anyone who plays League of Legends, this is what Ahri is in League of Legends, the nine-tailed fox spirit, who is, by myth, would seduce men to bring them home and have sex with them and kill them. But this particular, episode of television and interpretation of this is very, very dark and gruesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When she, yeah. I mean, if if the end of the fifth episode is gory, then the 15-minute mark here where the Kamiho essentially unleashes like 20 different tentacles onto this man is...
It's actually nine. Those are the nine tails.
Sorry.
They're snaking all over the place, but the myth is the nine-tailed fox spirit. And during the episode, quite a few times I was counting on my fingers, because there's a significance between, where they're coming out of and the number nine. Let's put it that way. You can do the math on that.
Got it. Good to know.
Yeah. We'll get into it.
The eyes, the one when it came out the eyes, I was like, what the f-? The eyes, for some reason I was like kind of like, that's like what freaked me out was the eyes. So then like you realize like just kind of like, okay, so like this is like, it's very jarring, right? And then after that, it morphs into this kind of Korean war romance where she meets Tick. Tick ends up killing one of her friends due to an order from his boss. Tick then gets injured. It's a very classic, what's the syndrome? Nightingale, when the nurse falls in love with the patient.
I have no idea what that's called.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
You want to call it Nightingale? We can refer to it as Nightingale.
Something, Force Nightingale? Syndrome, whatever. I want to know what the syndrome is.
You've lost me. I'll Google it. You keep talking.
Florence Nightingale effect. Yes.
Okay.
When the caretaker of someone falls in love, when someone who's injured at their caretaker falls in love with them, right? So there's a little bit of that where Tick gets injured, so she hates him and she wants to kill him, but she starts to kind of feel for him. And then they start talking about the Count of Monte Cristo, and he kind of flirts with her, and she kind of gets into him, and then they start dating, kind of, and it becomes this romance. But then she struggles because she's mad at him for killing her friend, but she starts to feel for him, and she doesn't understand what to do with kind of these human emotions and human feelings, right? And this is where, like, the episode becomes tragic because you initially feel sympathetic for this human character. Then you get terrified that she's this evil monster spirit thing. Then you feel happy that she's found this romance, even if it's this weird romance with a guy who killed her friend. And then there's this tragicness because then you realize that because of who she is, she will never be able to have that feeling be fully reciprocated, because when she accidentally reveals herself to Tick obviously freaks the fuck out and runs away from her, right?
Yeah.
And so episode kind of goes through this whole emotional arc in one episode, and it tells a very tight story. And like, regardless if this was a part of a bigger arc, right? If this was just a short film, it could essentially work on its own. Like, you don't need to have seen a single episode of Lovecraft Country to appreciate 95% of this episode, basically, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's exactly what I liked about this one is there's kind of like, when an episode starts like midway, because this is the exact like halfway point of the season. And when an episode like this starts and you open into a multiple years earlier with a character you haven't actually seen before, even though it's, you can make the connection that you've heard her on the phone, maybe like with one or two lines of dialogue. And you start to wonder like, okay, is this like a flashback? And then as it draws longer, you're like, okay, we're doing this. Like, this is the episode. This is the whole episode. And you figure at some point, like maybe at the end or maybe toward the middle, it's going to tie back in. But this is like, if you're going to do a show like this, I think it's better to lean further into the episodic anthology vibe rather than try and half-ass a serial plot, which I think is a lot of the weaker episodes. That was what made them weaker. But this was just the height, I think, of the season for me, because it's where they leaned the hardest into doing an episodic anthology, sci-fi horror, fantasy horror type show.
Yeah. And it was just very the emotional arc of her character and for a single episode, it varies a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to push Jamie Chung for an Emmy for this episode next year.
I'm sure she could get something. I'm just not, is she, depending on if she's guest actress, she could get a win if she's supporting.
She may not win, but I think she could get nominated.
She's probably a supporting actress because she's in a couple of later episodes. Yeah. So,
but yeah, so really well done. I think, like I said, the Korean romance part was a bit generic, but I'll be honest, that's because I've seen those movies. I think for many people,
I'm gonna guess the average person doesn't watch a lot of Korean or romance dramas.
I can see that that's something maybe specific to me. And so yeah, I think very tightly done. Visually very, it has very little effects except for a few scenes. So what I liked about this episode is that when it goes into that like Lovecraftian horror element, it's very impactful.
Right? Yeah, that's a good point, because in most of the episodes you kind of have like elaborate set pieces, elaborate costuming, but this one, even I think the camera style and the colors used in this episode were very different. Obviously, it is set in a war overseas.
But then, very white, snowy.
It's so minimalist and like low tech that when, you know, in the couple, you know, impactful horror type scenes, you just like all of a sudden like paint an entire simple Korean house room red with an ocean of blood.
Right.
Just very very jarring.
Yeah. So I think it was a very good episode. And when you're saying, you know, that's kind of like Black Mirror, I actually think this episode is what the show should have been basically more, which is like Black Mirror, which is the episode should have been an anthology that were connected more in spirit than in plot. And I think it could have worked better like that, because this episode, like I said, stands on its own. And if you had more episodes that were like this, even if you didn't have that overarching plot or narrative, I would have liked it more, because I think there's a lot of potential to tell this type of short stories in episodic form.
Yeah. So I think that's a good segue. Let's talk about episode 9, which is the one that you chose to talk about. This is called Rewind 1921, which, because we've all now seen Watchmen, and it's been, you know, in the public discourse quite a bit, we all know what happened in Tulsa in 1921. And that is where we go for most of this episode. So Sean, I think you wanted to talk about this one for a different reason. This the low point for you?
That's interesting. So I think I think Watchmen hurts at number one.
Yes, it's the same as before. Like you brought Meet Me and Daegu down because it's like, oh, I've seen part of this before.
Yeah,
Watchmen nailing the pilot episode with Tulsa 21. I don't know if this was in the works before that, but it is very, it does suffer a bit from that.
I didn't like to take such a significant historical event and intertwine this like MacGuffin search for this like book into it. Right. And didn't like how like the spoiler, the big reveal that like Tick himself is the guy who saves his own father.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Not ignoring the fact that we've seen Tulsa 21 already and recently, that twist is the most overdone time travel trope of all time. Like that was when they started talking about that, I was like, okay, we all know where this is going. And they did nothing with it that was uniquely anything good. Like it was the same.
I just don't like, because, and Tulsa is such, it's a very, and like Watchmen enhanced the relevance and importance of the Tulsa event, right? This dehanced it. Like, this made it seem not, like, it actually, like, took away from what it really was, in my opinion.
Yeah, so no, exactly. I know what you mean.
So I had a lot of issues with it because I think this is where the show, and this also, the same thing with the Emmett Till thing. I really hated that they had Emmett Till as a character in the show. Like, I really hated that.
Like real early, right?
Yeah, this is like episode 3 or 4. So remember when they're having the party and Dee and her friends are doing the Ouija board? So they don't say his name is Emmett Till in the thing, but he asked the thing, he's like, is my trip to Mississippi gonna go? Am I gonna have fun on my trip to Mississippi? Right? And then he looks like Emmett Till, and then obviously in episode 7, I think, or 8, I think it's 8. Yeah, I forget. 7 or 8. The beginning of the episode is like the Emmett Till died.
Yeah.
And Dee was his friend and stuff like that, right? Like, I was like, you don't... why are you incorporating a fantasy horror element to the Emmett Till story? And like, that's where I get to Tulsa. It's just like, I just did not like the intertwining of a significant historical event. Like, if you're going to do it, then you have to, like, that's why The Watchmen gets credit, because if you do it, you need to make sure you give it its respect and also enhance kind of its relevance and importance in a modern context, and not just use it for, like, the sake of, like, a plot point, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because the fact that it was Tulsa 21, was not actually relevant to their search for the book or anything. It was just, hey, this is like, let's just do this just because. What I liked about it, I think, was the potential of it, because Watchmen didn't, if I remember correctly, Watchmen didn't really explore like the, you know, what that place was like before the massacre. And this kind of started off, you know, the events before, and kind of paints this picture of like, I think there was a prom happening, and there was, you know, there was family life for it. But I agree with you. If you're going to tell that story, which I think would be a good story, it almost should be like a full episode just dedicated to telling the, like a full narrative, of the events of that day. Almost like, you know, what would be funny is if, what's it called? They could do like 1917, like the movie 1917, but do 1921 and do it in the same like one take style. I think that would make a great movie.
A movie or an episode of TV?
Either one. I'm just saying, like the way they told the story of 1917 through kind of like a, you know, from start to finish, like what's going on in the events of over the course of a day. Having it rather than jumping back and forth between storylines that have nothing to do with what's going on, it would be really cool to see something like that done about that day in history.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you'd have to, again, just depends on execution.
Well, that's why I mentioned 1917. Like, give it to a director who can. Who can pull that off?
Yeah, I don't know. So I brought that up, that episode, because I wanted to sort of highlight how I think the show never, like, when it found its right footing, it did things really well. But the episode 9 is kind of where I was like, yeah, like, I get what you were maybe trying to do, but, like, it just, in my opinion, did not work. And, like, I think in some ways, episode 9 highlights the difficulty of what the sure it was attempting in incorporating, you know, these sci-fi Lovecraftian horror elements with a racial subtext and like historical period piece, right? Like, it's juggling all these different things, and like, when it works, it's really good. But like episode 9 is like, yeah, and then when it doesn't work, you're kind of like, oh, this was kind of dumb.
Yeah. Well, I guess also one thing is they didn't actually have much like Lovecraftian horror in that episode. It was just like a kind of a shitty time travel story.
True. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that Lovecraftian element is like, I guess Dee was cursed in the beginning. And yeah. Yeah, you're right. I guess there's not that much.
That was probably the problem with it, because this, like, without that point, like, this is kind of like we were saying earlier, this is a very episodic episode. Like, it's doing like its own thing, that's like partially related to the main plot, but they just I think this was an execution mishap.
So wasn't the biggest fan of that choice. And it was also really weird as like a penultimate episode.
Yeah.
And I think we can maybe segue into that. And I think this is kind of why I didn't. I think episode eight is the Emmett Till one where like Dee is being chased by the girls, right?
Yeah. Jigga, yeah. Bobo.
Yeah. So I think episode 8 was to me the last like quality episode. I thought 9 fell flat, and then 9 falling flat to me, I can segue to the finale. I think the finale just kind of was eh, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I have the same thought. I was expecting bigger. The ending felt pretty straightforward. And I don't know where they're going to go with this season, or if there is a season 2 or whatever. I have no idea what the plan is, but I don't know where they would go from here. I thought the kind of post-ending with Dee's robot arm and Christina trapped under a rock was kind of pointless.
Yeah, I don't get, was that trying to allude, like, was it trying to, like, allude to, like, Dee becoming, like, some, like, evil person?
I have no idea. Yeah, it doesn't really, I don't make sense. I also don't like that the Shoggoth, the big Shoggoth that was summoned earlier at the end of episode 8, I think, kind of was not relevant to anything else that happened. That seemed significant when it came up, literally out of the ground. But then it was kind of just literally locked away in a basement in the finale. And I guess it showed up later to rescue Dee, but that had no bearing on the rest of what was going on in the episode. So overall, I think endings are very important to you and I specifically, yeah. But really to everyone. And even in an episodic focused show, I think to make it to number one spots on any lists we make, you've got to have an ending on, you know, the level of The Americans or The Leftovers. This series definitely did not.
No, it. So I think there's two things. One, it didn't tie up things. It kind of tied up things very boringly and like very just like generically. The twists in the episodes were very obvious. Like the whole twist with the metamorphosis of Ruby, I was like, yeah, no shit. Like, of course, right? I also thought that they did a bad job throughout the season, in my opinion, of like making Christina a hateable villain, right?
Like, I don't know if she was supposed to be. Like, that's, I almost think like that was a mistake in the finale, because I think, oh man, it's weird. Like, it's almost like the tension between in the latest Star Wars movies, where it felt like one director had a very clearly different vision than the other and tried to like undo what was being done. Cause Christina to me wasn't, maybe it was just cause of like her freaking outfits were just like fucking fire her and Journey Smollett in this series, like the costuming, if this doesn't win fucking the Emmy for that next year, that's going to be a travesty. Cause the outfits on all the characters, but specifically Christina and Letty, were just fire emoji 3 times. I completely forgot the point I was trying to make before that.
That she's not, no, she was
Christina.
She wasn't she wasn't built up as this villain enough, so that when she became this like generic evil villain character at the end of that finale, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, like she, I think even in the earlier episodes, like they were building like some level of sympathy for her, because there was the whole thing about like her being like, you know, a woman kind of like who was like not included in things, you know, and her father was like, you know, is the guy, literal like guys club with all these lodges and all the lore behind that. So I feel like they needed to either not have that finale, or yeah, it was just weird. Like, I'm not sure like what they were trying to go for with D, like killing her. Like, was that supposed to be like something we were rooting for? Or like, is D supposed to be a villain? I don't even know. It's all, I'm not sure what they're trying to say other than fuck white people.
Yeah, no, that's pretty, yeah. And like that, I don't like that she wasn't hated. Like, yeah, she was evil and a villain. And I'm not saying she was good. I think she was more evil than good throughout the series. But at the end of the finale, she just literally, it's like literally the most generic, like, evil person performing dark ritual on the hero, and like some deus ex machina event has to happen to stop them. And it was like, I mean, it's like Harry Potter shit to me. It's like literally like that's what it was. It was just like a very generic fantasy climactic battle, right? And so, but she was evil, but she wasn't hateable enough that like when she died, you were like, yeah, like we finally like killed that like evil person. You were just like,
yeah,
okay, like, yeah. It was
that dress though during the ritual.
Oh, very nice.
Looks good, like, in both white and red.
Like, it would have been easier if they had made that cop character the person instead, because he was very hateable.
What happened to him? Like,
he just
like,
died.
He was just there. Like, he was just there, and then he was not there, and then he was there again, and yeah. I don't even know. Like,
it for so the problem with the show, in my opinion, is that when it was kind of episodic and just focusing on some, like the Korean episode was really good, but what ends up happening is that it still is trying to tell this like larger plot narrative, and then at the end it just like rushes it like significantly, and it just is like, all right, like, he's dead. She's now super evil. She's also dead. Like, it's like Ruby died off screen. Like, you know, like all this, like things just happen really quick. And they still don't really save Tick. They just kill her. Right. And they prevent white people from using magic, which I don't really understand how that works. Right. Is it like if you're half white, half black, are you like,
can like, really use half magic?
I was kind of like how does this work? Like, do you have to be like,
that was just a weird line to me. I'm like, what? Like, that's your, like, is that what you're trying to say as a show? Is like, I guess what they're going for is like, oh, we need, like, we can't let any white person ever have magical powers because they will use it, because all white people are racist, and if any white person has magic, they will use it to oppress non-white people.
Yeah,
I don't know what they were doing with that line. It felt just thrown in there, like it had nothing to do with. She was like, "Oh, you took away my magic," and they're like, "No, not just you. All white people's magic.
Even Harry Potter can't use magic."
Yeah, Harry Potter can't have magic anymore. Voldemort just took over Britain. All right, it's done.
My friend who we wanted originally have on this podcast, but due to scheduling concerns, we couldn't have it. He felt similarly in the sense that it was a very, its take on like racial elements and themes was sometimes really good and relevant, but then sometimes just like completely rudimentary and elementary and basic. And like the show really leans more towards that all white people are racist than anything else. And like, yes, in the 1950s that was definitely more true than it is today. And like, yes, a lot of white people are racist, but then when you watch the show in 2020, it's like, okay, but like, that's not revealing. You're not revealing anything about today's society, right? Because, like, it's like, no, like the show was, like, generically racist sometimes, or it's just like, it's like, oh, like, this black guy touched this white woman, and all of a sudden 10 cops just show up out of nowhere and start harassing him.
Yeah, it's like saying Candyman three times.
Yeah, it's like, yes, it happened. Yes, I'm not denying, you know, that. But the show literally, like, was like, every typical all white people are racist, and, like, black people are always, like, are no matter what they do, are going to get beat up by white people for doing stuff. Like, every trope that they could think of, they used in the show, right? It just got to the point where I'm like, I don't think you're actually saying anything that intelligently. Like, I'll go back to episode 5 in The Metamorphosis, because I think that was where the racial subtext was interesting, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think most of the show, and I think that's why that episode stands out, because I don't think the show achieved that with its racial social commentary in most of its episodes.
The show, I think, as a whole, just really didn't have a vision for where it was going and how it was tying everything together. But, you know, when it was operating in that episodic anthology style, most of them were fairly good. So where does that leave the show as a whole for you, you know, in the landscape of 2020? I can get into where it's tentatively landing on my best of the year list, but I want to hear what you think.
So you definitely have a better in terms of ranking. I won't really go ranking because you've seen more 2020 than I have, but I think just like overall as TV, I think I appreciate the show much more than I enjoyed it. I think production wise, very great show. Like we talked about, costume designs, camera, cinematography, like high quality show, which is what you expect from HBO. Acting for the most part, everyone is into it and sells it. And then when the show does get it right, it is really good. And when it doesn't get it right, it's kind of dumb. So like, I think it's a good show. I would recommend it to people. I appreciate it. But at the end of the day, like, I don't think it's a great show. I think it was a great attempt at a great show and falls a bit short and ends up just being good and not great.
So, let's play a little game, because I have my tentative best 20 shows of 2020 list up right now. You've seen some of these. So you've seen Hollywood, right?
No, I saw one episode. Oh,
okay, never mind. You've seen
Perry. Let's start with Perry Mason.
You saw the new... Oh, Perry. Okay, Perry Mason. So guess, is this higher or lower than Perry Mason?
Wait, me or for you?
For on my list right now, you guess what I'm...
Oh, this is lower.
I have it currently higher, but this is before this whole discussion. What about The New Pope?
Lower.
It's actually very close, but I'm debating. Currently, it's one above New Pope.
Okay.
You saw Mrs. America?
Yeah, okay. Lower.
Lower than Mrs. America. The Great?
Definitely lower.
Yeah. So... right now, and let me think, have you seen Raised by Wolves yet?
No, but I'm gonna say higher.
Yeah, it is. What else have you seen? I don't think
Devs.
Oh, well, Devs is currently number one on the list.
Yeah, so I was gonna say Devs.
You can probably assume. Yeah, Devs and Normal People are currently number one and two on the list. So so this is sitting at number 7 right now. I'm debating between Perry Mason. Basically, it's in a level with Perry Mason, Unorthodox, and The New Pope, and I don't know what to do with it. It's sitting right below Little Fires Everywhere.
So Perry Mason, the way I view it is that, again, Perry Mason has a lot of the same quality, like high production value, good acting, all that stuff. I thought Perry Mason was slightly more consistent, which is why I would like it. I think it's the high points of Lovecraft Country are higher, but Perry Mason has had a more consistent quality week to week or episode to episode. So, and I like that, right? I think when I watch a TV show, I do value consistency, right? I don't really like when you go from like high to low a lot.
Sense. Same regard, it's also kind of it was a little more predictable, and I like unpredictability.
Fair, yeah. Perry Mason is, yeah, you know what you're getting, right?
I like consistent high quality, but also unpredictability, and that's very hard to do. It's hard to be unpredictable and consistent in quality.
Devs is probably the only show to do that this year, then.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, yeah.
If anything,
the great was unpredictable.
If anything, I think this makes me appreciate devs more, because when I watch a show like Lovecraft Country, I appreciate its effort a lot, but I'm like, it kind of fell short. And then devs, I'm like, oh, like this is how like you actually try really hard and like actually accomplish mostly what you want to do.
Yeah. I think it comes down to creative vision, because, you know, Devs is a show that had a single person who ran the creative vision, and Lovecraft Country was very much a writer's room type show.
No, I think that we talked about that in that episode of Devs. I think that kind of shows why you and I both feel that in moving forward, you know, the best way to get high quality kind of content is for studios to put faith in kind of these showrunners to just kind of run these shows on their own, right? Because having, just like movies and films, like when you treat it as like a 8-hour film, right, and you have one person drive it, right, if you have the right person driving it, you really get a great TV show, right? And so Chernobyl's like another amazing example of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think though it's a good show. I think that ranking is fair. I could see it going lower or higher as you, when you finish out your ranking at the end of the year. I think you would agree though that it would definitely be a recommend show. Like if someone asked me, should I watch Lovecraft Country? I would say yes. Would I necessarily say yes over, like, I would tell them watch Devs first, but like if they're not into sci-fi or whatever, but they're interested in this for whatever reason, I would tell them, yeah, sure, go ahead, but I wouldn't urge them to see it at the same time.
I mean when I put out my list at the end of the year, I usually try and do some kind of, you know, if you like X, then
yeah,
you know, you'll like this. So what would that X be for Lovecraft Country? I definitely think, like, if you're into, like, you know, Get Out and that type of horror.
Like, Watchmen is probably the closest TV show of recent year note that probably has some overlap, right? Which tries to, you know, it's social commentary with, like, a high concept type of thing, right? I think Watchmen is, like, the closest thing from that perspective.
And obviously, like, if you like H.P. Lovecraft, you know, literature.
Also, Atlanta to some extent, because Atlanta
that's a good comparison. Yeah,
Atlanta,
I've only seen a bit of it, but
does kind of atypical, like tries to talk about things in an atypical way, right? And uses surrealism into it, maybe not horror and sci-fi, but there's like surrealism at least. So I think Atlanta, Watchmen are kind of probably the two shows which I think in recent times would be relevant. Last thing though, before we wrap up, do you know if this is going to, the ratings were pretty good for the show, so I think in terms of ratings and viewership, like I think it would justify HBO giving another season, but is there plans for it? And I don't know how it would work, and I don't know if you would think it could work either.
I don't know. Cursory Google search seems to imply that there is a season two planned, but no details yet as to, like, you know, new characters or who's even running it. It sounds like they've confirmed it's returning, and they're confirming that Tick is dead, and so this is happening, and I'm sure I'll watch it when it comes out in 2025. Who knows? I have no idea. I'm excited for it. I think this is one of those shows that maybe could ramp up and get better if they fix some of the issues of this. Let's wrap up with one more question. What is the best thing you've seen recently? And also, we have maybe two more months left in 2020. What do you see coming out that could potentially upset my list right now?
So the first one, I will say, I saw American Murder, The Family Next Door on Netflix. And so I don't try to promote true crime too often. However, I did enjoy this. I shouldn't enjoy is a wrong word. I found it very interesting because, so for those who don't know, it's essentially a movie. It's a 90-minute film essentially about that recaps kind of this murder of this family that happened in Denver a couple of years ago. And I won't reveal much more than that because it'll get too spoilerific. But why I found it interesting is because the entire movie is told exclusively through camera footage, like home videos and social media and text messages and social media posts. So there's no like interviews, testimonials. There's no like current day like footage of people. It's just telling the footage that they had from like the family's home videos, from social media posts, from some like public access cameras that they were able to get. Like, so it tells a whole story just with that. And there's no narration or anything like that. And I found it really fascinating how the directors and editors found a way to put all this footage together and tell a very cohesive story from start to end that flowed and made sense. So,
So it's like documentary. It's like pure documentary with no editorializing.
Yeah, it literally. That's exactly the best way to describe it. It's a pure documentary with no. I mean, there's editing of the footage, but there's nothing. There's no added narration or anything outside of those footage itself. So you're just observing kind of, you know, the people as they are. So it's and then it uses text messages as like they use text messages kind of as a way to like kind of tell the narration. And so I thought it was really well done. I think if you're into true crime, I would definitely recommend it. I thought it was one of the better true crime things I've seen. So yeah. That's kind of the best thing I saw recently. In terms of things that could upset, you had mentioned Mythic Quest coronavirus episode. I believe Euphoria has two coronavirus episodes coming out in December.
Oh, I did not know that. I am very excited about that.
I don't know if they're coronavirus episodes, but I know they're. I think they are.
That is interesting.
When's that
coming out?
December. Yeah, it is special COVID episode. That's what they're deeming it. Which will bridge season one and season two. So I need to catch up on it because I am actually really interested. I think they're gonna have to see. I think Euphoria is a show in which they will have to kind of have coronavirus in it, because it's a show that's trying to be like. It's the premise of the show is like, this is like teens today, right? And you can't really have a show about teens anymore without addressing like coronavirus.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting. And I think, wow, yeah. But I'm concerned about that going into, because I do eventually want like a real second season.
Yeah.
We'll see.
What I don't know is, I don't know when they say COVID episode, if it means that they were made under COVID guidelines or if they will follow, like if there will be about the coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, because when you first said that, I was picturing, you know, like Zendaya and Hunter Schaefer, like, you know, going to school over Zoom calls and.
No idea. I think I don't know. I don't know how they did it. I don't know. Maybe it's like that. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Okay.
So I think that answers your second one. Question.
Yeah. For me, I'm excited to check out have you looked into or seen the trailer for The Queen's Gambit on Netflix?
Yeah, everyone's talking about that.
About it? I haven't heard anything.
Oh,
I saw the trailer and it looks good.
It came out on Friday, so at least my film Twitter is talking about it because people really like Anya Taylor-Joy. She, yeah, So
is she the main lead?
Yeah. So Anya Taylor-Joy was she. If for those who are cinephiles, she was in The Witch. So she's kind of a scream queen type of person. She was in The Witch. She was in M. Night Shyamalan's Split and later Glass. And she was in recently The New Mutants. So she's had an early career of like these horror films. And so she's kind of had success there. She just recently got the role for, they're making a Mad Max prequel about Furiosa character. And she got the lead in that. So she's like a very up and coming kind of like, she's going to be the next big it girl kind of, you know, Brie Larson, Jennifer Lawrence type of actress. So this show, Film Twitter is very excited about the show because of her.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, all I know is miniseries, period piece, and Jess, good and, reviews. So,
oh, and also the premise is that she is like a rebel chess player. So like, yeah, if you're like a nerd,
it's based on a true thing, right?
Yeah. But like, if you're like a nerd, but you also are a punk, then it's like the perfect mess.
It's based on a book. Yeah. But I don't know if the book is based on a true story.
Yeah. I may watch that. I may watch that. How do we now classify, these movies which aren't coming out in theaters? So like, does Borat 2 count as a TV movie?
It might. I don't know. I don't know if we really talk much about TV movies anyway.
Fair.
On this podcast.
Yeah, fair. I was just thinking. But yeah,
I mean, we glossed over that Emmy category. So if we're not going to talk about the Emmy category,
that is true. Well, because fair enough. Fair enough. But yeah, I think it's a, it's crazy that we're heading towards the end of the year. I don't know.
Are we though? Are we really moving that fast?
we'll see. this episode comes out end of October. I think our next episode we will be in a very different state of the country when we record our next episode. I'll just say that.
Everybody get out there and vote for the Emmys.
For the Emmys. The presidential election. I'm pretty sure most people have. I think as of this recording, 60 million people have already sent out their ballots. So I'm pretty sure that our devoted following has probably sent out their ballots as well. So yeah, I think interesting time. TV, hopefully, I think the filming is starting up again. I think depending on obviously how this virus goes, but I think we're getting through this time. I think we'll see kind of a dearth of content for a couple more months, but I think starting spring and summer, a lot of the shows that were supposed to come out this year will wrap up, and we'll see those episodes of TV that we missed out in 2020.
And like, one day we will see Dune.
Oh my god, I don't know
about all right that. Well, with that, thank you all for listening. This has been our recap of HBO's Lovecraft Country, and we'll see you again in the next episode, which we have fuck all of a plan for.
Yeah, hopefully the country's still around. See you later.
All right. On that optimistic note, bye everyone.